Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, June 6th. I'm Ray Graff. Astronomer Bob Berman has returned to Studio A for the first Vox Pop show following our successful $1 million fund drive, and he is here to answer your astronomy questions. You know, Bob is one of the best known, most widely read astronomers in the world. He is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. His latest book is Earth Shattering: The Violent Supernovas, Galactic Explosions, and Earthly Mayhem That Shook Our Universe. If you have a question for Bob, the number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Astronomer Bob Berman at your calls coming up right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Astronomer Bob Berman is back to answer all of your astronomy-related questions. Bob is the astronomy editor for Old Farmer's Almanac, a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. His latest book, his latest of many, many books, is Earth Shattering: The Violent Supernovas, Galactic Explosions, and Earthly Mayhem That Shook Our Universe. If you have a question about the heavens, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can tweet us at WAMCVoxPop, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back, sir.
Great to be here, Ray. Thank you.
The fund drive was a smashing success, and we're back here. The only drawback with doing the call-in show so soon after the fund drive is that I will probably give the wrong number a couple of times. So I'll write it down, 800-348-2551, if people want to call in. Let's talk about Mercury for a minute. Now, driving in, you know, I do the early shift with Alan during the fund drive, and I was driving in, I don't know, 5 o'clock in the morning, and I think it was on WAMC. Maybe it wasn't, but I heard a bit about Mercury, and it surprised me that there is actually ice on Mercury. It's so close to the sun. How could that possibly be?
Because Mercury is the only planet that doesn't have a tilt to its orbit. It's just straight up and down.
Yeah.
So it means at the poles, the sunlight is hitting it sideways. And if you have a depression at the pole,
right,
a crater-like thing, but this is deeper, as Mercury does, no sun ever gets in there.
Interesting. Now, the moon has ice in craters, too. And yet the moon, similar to Mercury, as far as I know, that there's not a lot of atmosphere. Where does the water come from?
Well, it could come from comet impacts. All these objects have been hit over the billions of years many times. And if you can't sublimate it, if you can't get rid of the ice, it's going to stay there. So, yeah, it's got good old-fashioned water ice.
Will there be more comets hitting Mercury because it is so close to the sun?
Well, Jupiter really bends a lot of comet orbits and sends them inward toward the sun, and more whip around the sun than not. But yeah, fair share hit Mercury. And it's only once a year for a week or so that Mercury is really easily seen, and that happens to be now.
Okay, and where will we see it?
Well, the thing is, you need a flat western horizon that a lot of us don't have.
It's very low.
Yeah, it's low. It's not like super low, like right on the horizon, but it's about 10 degrees up, which is about a clenched fist held at arm's length. Mm-hmm. If you put the bottom of the fist on the horizon 40 minutes after sunset, so we're talking about a little after 9 o'clock.
Okay.
Then the top of the fist shows you where Mercury is. It's not dim. It's bright. It looks like a bright star. Not dazzling, but a bright star. Binoculars help, but you really don't need them. So a bright star down low 40 minutes after sunset, and there it is. And what's making it even better is that it's meeting Mars. And it's closely meeting Mars from now until Wednesday.
So how close?
Close enough so that the two look almost touching.
Really?
Now, Mercury is much brighter looking than Mars, but especially through binoculars, they'll both look orange. And it's very, very cool. This is going to go on, as I say, from now till next Wednesday. So
Mercury must be very bright. I mean, Mars is very bright on a good night.
Yeah, but right now it's on the far side of the sun, about as far as it can ever get from us. Mm-hmm. In fact, it varies. Those two, Mercury and Mars, vary their brightness by more than any other planet can. Mm. So they're both in the same ballpark with that. Yeah.
I assume if you were to train a telescope on Mercury on these days where you can see it, you don't see much. You know, when you look at Venus through a telescope, it's just a very bright.
That's right. White. And Mars is so far away, it's really tiny.
Mercury.
Mars, too. I mean, we're talking about, since you brought up the topic of what planets not to bother with a telescope, those are the three, Mercury, Venus, and Mars. And so the real standouts, especially these nights, are Jupiter and Saturn.
But Mars is so beautiful to look at. Yeah. With the naked eye, it's orange.
Yes, when it's close, like a year ago, more than like we're talking about the summer before last, and even last summer, it was quite bright, but not now. No,
one summer, I don't know if it was last summer or the summer before, there were a number of planets, more or less,
yes,
in a line,
like a string of pearls,
in August.
Yes,
and it was amazing.
It was. That's all gone away. They're generally on the far side of the sun. The best planets, other than Mercury, now are Jupiter is at its closest to Earth tomorrow.
That's bright, big, bright.
Well, actually, it's Monday the 10th.
Yeah,
and it's really bright. So,
yeah.
And that's out conveniently dinner time. So we're talking about maybe 9:30, 10 o'clock, and then it's out all night long. But
right.
If you look in the east, you know, in the direction of sunrise, and you look low, right at nightfall, there's a bright, 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 really bright, brightest thing in the sky, and that's Jupiter at its closest to Earth. That's great. And a few hours later, midnight or so, look to the left of Jupiter, the brightest star to the left of Jupiter, that's Saturn. So these are the best planets if you have a backyard telescope. Those are the ones to point it to.
And worth it at all to get a good pair of binoculars? Will you see anything better?
Not really. Planets really need a higher power.
Yeah. The number to call here if you have an astronomy question for Bob Berman is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. All over the news the last several days, many sources. I just pulled one here from Popular Science. The moon keeps flashing us, and we have no idea why. And I'll just read this first paragraph here from an article by Neil Patel. If you stare at the moon hard enough with a powerful telescope, you'll notice something bizarre happening on the surface. Flashes of light will burst out momentarily, then vanish just as inexplicably fast. Humans have claimed to witness this for at least 1,000 years. Modern astronomers have documented the phenomenon since the latter half of the 20th century, dubbed transit lunar phenomenon. We've seen it over and over without any real understanding of its cause. Bob Berman, I got to tell you, I've been looking at the moon a long time, and I've never seen this, nor have I heard of it.
And I've never seen it, and all the amateur astronomers that we're in touch with at Astronomy Magazine, we've never gotten a letter about it. No one's ever mentioned it, and I probably spent, 1,000 or 2,000 hours of my life looking at the moon.
You've never seen it.
I've never seen it either. So, I don't doubt it. I'm sure it's happening. There's flashes, and nobody knows why. It could be meteor impacts. It could be some sort of upwelling of some strange gases or some effect with the sun interacting with the sun, something on the surface. Who knows? But, this article saying, well, if you look at the moon, you'll see it. I'm a little skeptical about that. But still, hey, interesting. Interesting phenomenon. It says it was first observed in the late 60s. So what about the 300 years since 1610 that people have been watching the moon obsessively through telescopes? Why wasn't it reported before that? So there's a lot of question marks floating around, like in the comic books.
Will you be taking a different look at the moon the next time you put the telescope on it?
Oh, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
All right, we'll see what happens. Bob Berman is our guest. This email came in, and then we'll take a break and get to the phones at 800-348-2551. This one is from Jill in Cornwall. Please give us your opinion on Elon Musk's SpaceX company's plan to launch thousands of Starlink satellites and their effects on the night sky. Did you see that first picture?
We're freaked. The astronomical community is freaked, and this is global, because the IAU, the International Astronomical Union, which is the world's astronomers, whose president, by the way, is our own Debbie Elmgreen, professor of astronomy at Vassar, right here in our listening area. And she is in charge of the world's astronomy. She's the president. And they just published a photo that some observatory tried to take of some distant galaxies. And in front of it are bright white lines that look as if you're trying to look through prison bars.
Yep.
Prison bars at the universe. So the question that we're all asking is, is this okay? Is it okay for companies, Starlink and a few others, who have already launched now suddenly dozens, and they plan to launch, listen to this,
thousands
of satellites. They'll all be visible crossing the sky, and there'll be more satellites than visible stars. More satellites than stars in the sky, and it'll be worldwide. So this is being done so that everybody can have 5G and other effects for their smartphones and stuff like that. And I guess people want that. But is it okay for the sky to lose its eternal nature of stars and the Milky Way and instead to constantly see bright lights crossing the sky with thousands of them doing that? Is this really okay? And that's, I guess, I'm wondering where all the nature organizations have been. Why aren't they up in arms?
Well, been complaining about plenty of other things over the last 150 years.
There is one bright note so that we don't seem too gloomy here, and that is you only see satellites for half the year because during the cold half of the year, as soon as darkness falls, our own planet's shadow is up there. So the satellites are then orbiting in our shadow and we don't see them.
Right.
And during this part of the year, we're talking about April through September. Now, this is satellite season now. You still don't see them for three quarters of the night. You only see them the first 90 minutes of darkness and the final 90 minutes of darkness. So between, say, around 10 or 10:30 and 3 in the morning, you won't see these satellites. So that's the good news.
Bob Berman is our guest. We'll take a quick break here. The number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop. Astronomy Today. We'll be back. One 800 348 2551 is the number. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Bob Berman is our guest. It's Astronomy Today, and let's jump on the phones here. And Tom in Elizaville. Tom, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome aboard.
Bob, thank you. Quick question. A good entry-level magnification telescope for little kids, 8, 7, 50X or 10X or what's good? I don't want to spend $2,000.
Right. Well, first of all, remember that every telescope doesn't come with a magnification. You take an eyepiece out and you put a new eyepiece in, and that changes the power, the magnification, and that's true for all telescopes. So
what, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so what we're really talking about is what would be easy and almost bulletproof that doesn't have mirrors that have to be collimated. And these days, a simple refractor, the kind you look through, through one end and the lens is on the other end, is simple, never has to be collimated. Make sure the tripod it comes with is not wobbly. Make sure it's rigid, and that's it. And I'm thinking of different companies to call, but we're not supposed to do.
What about computer control?
I'd avoid that.
Really?
Because there's so many setup steps where you have to first find a few stars and then push buttons and put in your time, put in your location, that it takes so long to do that a lot of people have trouble with them. So I think it's easier, actually, easier to learn the sky. Of course, you'll start on the moon. You don't need problems with that. The, the planets are bright. And then slowly, it's fun for kids to learn the sky, learn the things to look for, and then use your finder scope, which this will presumably come with, and point it at that. So that's the way.
Okay. Yeah, refractor. Just look to one end, look out the other end. I can put it on a tripod, bolt it to the ground, and I don't have to worry about them knocking it over or whatever. So
yeah, they're pretty bulletproof. Yep.
All right, Tom, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman is our guest, and Caitlin is in Hyde Park. Hello, Caitlin.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, how are you?
Good. I was just calling to ask what your expert opinion was on the reason the Younger Dryas era ended, if you think it was more likely that a series of asteroids hit the Earth, or possibly a mass coronal ejection happened, and that's why we had so much warming and the end of that ice age.
Well, there's some controversy about that, because although we know the most recent mass extinction, 66 million years ago, what used to be called the Cretaceous-Tertiary extinction, the older ones, like the Permian, 251 million years ago, are a little bit up in the air, because things were happening. There was a series of volcanoes called the Siberian Traps, strange name for volcanoes, that were changing the atmosphere of the Earth, putting a lot of carbon dioxide in the air. But at the same time, it turns out there was a big ocean bloom of strange creatures that were also changing the atmosphere. And then you can always have an impact. And if it was in the ocean, which makes up most of the planet even back then, you wouldn't necessarily find a clue about that it happened, because the ocean floor is remade every 200 million years. And so a little bit controversial. It could have been any one of those things, but it's true. We were this warm and warmer in the past, naturally.
All right. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. Bob Berman is our guest today. And let's go to Gene in Parksville. Gene, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about the listening telescope in Arecibo, Puerto Rico.
Right.
Based on the FSC, fine structure constant, for its principle of signal?
No, really. And remember that telescopes that are radio telescopes, like the Arecibo instrument, really don't listen. Most of the public thinks that they listen to things, but they don't. They're really detecting electromagnetic radiation, a form of light, just the kind that we can't see with our eyes. But these are just forms of electromagnetic radiation. And once it's received, even though all the movies show the astronomers with headsets on, as if now at least they're listening, they're still not listening, because the data comes in on as images, false color images, and on graphs and things like that. And no, it's just simple. This is part of the radio spectrum, and which needs to be detected differently from optical, mainly because the waves are so long compared to the optical part of the spectrum.
What wavelength are they mainly looking at?
And I hope you wouldn't ask me that. I can tell you the wavelengths of green light,
right?
In the visible spectrum, but wavelengths, all wavelengths. I we're talking about things though in the radio part of the spectrum that can be half a mile from crest to crest.
Wow. That's a long wave.
Yeah.
All right.
So the antenna in Puerto Rico is just sending out pulses of signals, you're saying?
Right. No, it's not sending out, and it's receiving. And it was a very interesting thing, because it just so happened that the shape of the land in that part of Puerto Rico was very close to a parabola to begin with.
So it was a natural parabolic dish.
Right.
So all you needed is to fill it in to make it smooth, and then you needed on cables a place where the focus of that parabola could be reached. So you have cables, and since you can't point something that's built into the Earth, how are you going to look at different parts of the sky? So the idea here is you move the receiving spot, the focus, on cables, and so you're using various parts of that curvature of the parabola to get your focal point for the signal, depending upon what part of the sky you want to look on. It's very cool.
All right, Gene, thanks for the call. It's 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Astronomy, the topic today. Let's go to Benjamin in Rexford. Benjamin.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Sure.
All right, so my question is about the aurora borealis. So I know that there's like some particles, I guess, coming from the sun that are interacting with the atmosphere.
Right.
And my question is, are they all coming in all the way to the Earth's surface, like in a point? Are they converging? And if so, would that be a dangerous place for a person to be?
Right. No, they're not converging. The sun sends out a steady stream of broken bits of atoms, both electrons, protons, the whole nine yards. That was postulated by Eugene Parker in the 50s. And in the great tradition of science, he was ridiculed. People said, oh, yeah, sure, the sun sends out a wind. Yeah, right. But the earliest satellites in the late 50s showed that he was right. And, I mean, he was pretty persuasive. He said, that's why comet tails all point away from the sun. It's like a wind pushing on it and blowing it away. It made sense.
Ow.
Yeah, so it's this stuff that as it sweeps past Earth and encounters our own magnetic field, these charged particles, anytime you get charged particles over a magnetic field, you generate electricity. And this is high voltage electricity. What actually happens is most of the stuff from the sun sweeps around us, gets bent around us, and then looks like it's made it past Earth. And then at a certain point, it gets pulled back again by the magnetotail. Earth's magnetosphere comes to like a teardrop shape. And at the far end, just when the solar broken bits of atoms or plasma looks like it's home free, no, then it gets, boom, pulled back, and then it follows the field lines to where the magnetic poles are. And so that's why we have rings or donuts that glow around not the poles of rotation of Earth, where Santa Claus lives, but the magnetic poles. It just so happens those permanent donuts of glowing light from these happen to be over places like Fairbanks, Alaska, which is why that town sees an aurora 2 out of 3 nights.
Ah.
It's just in the right spot. In the southern hemisphere, there is no spot on Earth over land that gets the aurora oval. So the aurora australis, which is down there, is just not over any land. Nobody sees it.
Okay, so they're staying above the Earth in space. They're not getting sucked into the Earth. They're getting sucked near the Earth, above it.
Yeah, I mean, the aurora is generally seen about 100 miles up. The lowest auroras are about 60 miles, still way, way higher than jetliners fly.
Mm.
And most auroras are up or closer to 100.
Thanks, Benjamin. We appreciate the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. I was reading an article today or yesterday about the solar minimum. And it was a kind of an alarmist piece saying, well, the sun has been very quiet for days now, and it's really hitting a low point. And the upshot of this article was, you know, the sun protects us from cosmic rays and everything else, and we're in danger now because there is really no activity. You know, it's a solar minimum.
Well, there's truth to that, because when the sun is stronger in its maximum, for example, around 8 years ago or 7 years ago when it was at its maximum, it tends to provide a push around the entire solar system, and it keeps cosmic rays, which are far more energetic and powerful than the sun's,
right.
It keeps them from coming into our solar system.
I thought nothing stopped cosmic rays. I thought they would go right through you and me and the Earth
and
everything else.
That's true of neutrinos, but not cosmic rays, because cosmic rays are all charged, and charged particles are susceptible to fields, to magnetic and electrical fields. So they come in. The sun definitely makes them... keeps them away. So, yeah, at solar minimum now. And the solar minimum has come about 2 years earlier than we expected. And so everybody's asking, what is going on? Solar cycle number 23, first that was stretched out, and it had this deep minimum that was deeper than anyone's seen in a century. Then when cycle 24 started, and now it's just ending, but when it started about 10 years ago, it started late.
Mm-hmm.
When it reached its peak, the peak was only half as strong as a normal solar peak of a solar cycle. And then it ended early. So it's like...
There's supposed to be 11-year cycles, right?
Yeah, and this time it was closer to 9 years.
Interesting.
And so everyone's asking, what will cycle 25 be like? Any time we should see the first signs of cycle 25, is it also going to be weak? Is it going to be truncated in some other way?
Are you confident there will be a cycle 25?
Well, if not, remember, we're thinking of the Maunder minimum,
right?
That 70-year period from 1645 to 1715, when the sunspot cycle just stopped. It just stopped. And Earth got cold, and weird things happened, and colonies had to be abandoned on Iceland and Greenland. And
the Thames froze over.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So there are researchers who are wondering, are these weird signs, perhaps we're entering an extended period of solar quiet and inactivity? And so we'll see what happens with cycle 25.
You're confident the sun is not dying?
Oh, no, not dying. We're talking about just the superficial, the stuff that happens on the photosphere.
Bob Berman is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. Tom is in Bristol, Vermont. Tom, you're on.
Hi. Hey, Bob.
Hi.
I don't have a question. I would just like you to inform that earlier caller who was talking about buying a telescope to never look at the sun.
That's a really good observation.
Right. Yes. The only person I know who's ever damaged their eyes astronomically was somebody who used binoculars on the sun and has permanent damage.
Why would you do that?
Of the eye. I don't know. So, that's the most dangerous thing you could do. You'd think people would be smart enough not to do that. I was not. When I was a kid looking for Venus.
You looked at the sun anyway.
I was looking at the edge of the sun because these things were going to be so close. And I once skimmed the edge of the sun for just the tiniest split second. And I'm very lucky not to have suffered eye damage.
All right. So, let's reiterate. Don't look at the sun. Don't point a telescope or binoculars at the sun. That's great advice. Tom, thank you for the call. Bob Berman is our guest. 800-348-2551 is our number. Chris, who is on the road. Chris, you're on.
Wow. Hi. First time caller.
Hey, great. Nice to have you here.
Hi. I just a quick comment on the spots on the moon.
Yeah.
I've actually seen them with my bare eyes, and I thought I was going crazy because I worked long hours at night.
Yeah.
Little flashes. And with my question to water on planets, what's your take on the electric theory and electricity creating this water and not comets?
Water on what planets?
Just planets in general. I recently started watching a show on Gaia. I shouldn't be saying this on television.
That's okay. You're allowed.
Okay. And they pretty much talk about their theory is the electric universe and how everything is connected through electricity, and that high voltages actually create the water vapor that have been found on planets and comets and other things like that.
What do you think, Bob?
Well, how would high voltage create H2O unless these things were present?
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't plan on having to respond to
that. You had hydrogen and oxygen.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, in the early solar system, we know that there were more comets than now, that they were just everywhere. And we know that comets hit things. We watched it. Remember Shoemaker-Levy 9 hitting Jupiter?
Oh, that was very nice.
What was that, 25 years ago?
Yep.
And so we see comets come in, and they're mostly water. And so the amount of comets that would have to hit to have given Earth all of its water were prodigious, but there were prodigious comets. So that's something that works. If you had the hydrogen and the oxygen, then in the right electric field, I guess there'd be the energy to create water? I'm just trying to think of how. Electricity, of course, is famous for disassociating
water.
Can you
do that in a lab, though?
Well, we've all, remember from high school chemistry, we've all seen how electric current changes water into hydrogen and oxygen. It disassociates with the energy.
Right.
I have never seen a demonstration of a hydrogen and oxygen separately turning into water, but you could. For example, when the Hindenburg disaster happened.
Yes.
And we saw clouds of smoke surrounding the flames. That smoke was water vapor being created by the hydrogen in the dirigible meeting the oxygen in the atmosphere.
Oh.
So there was water being created out of separate hydrogen and helium. So who knows?
All
maybe.
Right. Well, Chris, thank you for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. It's astronomy, and we have more to come. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Bob Berman, Astronomy Today. A few emails here, Bob, and then we'll jump back to the phones for the home stretch. Oh, this one's from our buddy Nancy. And Nancy, thank you for the lovely pledge during the fun drive. Nancy writes, okay, so why in heaven's name, pun intended, is there no regulation of satellites? Are they going to allow unlimited satellite deployment until some saturation point or accident or international incident brings the whole mess to a sudden halt? Too late, naturally. What could possibly go wrong? And that's from our friend Nancy. And she says, P.S., or am I overthinking this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I like nature. You know, I think there should be a time for nature, a time to get away from your smartphone and computer and step into unspoiled nature. And the sky, I know I'm biased, but the sky is one of those, you know, refuges for infinity. And so to see thousands of satellites constantly crossing the sky and you lose that night sky purity, that doesn't feel right. And not to mention all the electromagnetic radiation from all these satellites, boom, all the time, penetrating everything to bring you, constant 5G or what have you. Mm. No, of course I'd vote against it, but I'd probably be outvoted by the world, by most people in the world.
Okay. This one came in from Bill. And Bill writes, is it possible to see the orbiting space station from the ground at night without assistance? Of course it is.
Yes.
Very bright.
It looks bright. It's quite bright.
Yeah.
And there are places, I believe there's a website called Heavens Above that will give you, you give your location, either the city or your latitude and longitude, and it'll tell you each night when the space station will pass above you. It'll also tell you about Iridium satellites, since we're talking about satellites. Those are the ones with the huge solar panels that occasionally will reflect the sun.
Flash quickly.
And produce this brilliant flash over your location.
Yeah.
It'll tell you exactly where to look, how high up, in what direction, and the exact time to the second to expect it from your house.
And so, I think some of those star apps, I know I have two on my phone, and I believe at least one of them, if you see a very bright, slow-moving object and you hold it up, it'll tell you if it's the ISS.
Oh, that's cool. That's
cool. This one is from Laura in lovely Brewster, New York, and then we'll jump back on the phones. Could Bob please explain what happens to matter once it falls into a black hole and is torn asunder? Does it get ejected into another dimension of time, or does it fall out into the backside of our galaxy? Well, there goes the whole show, Laura.
Well, no, nobody knows is the short answer to that, because matter, once it's within a certain distance from the singularity at the center of the black hole, that distance is called the Schwarzschild radius, and it defines where the event horizon is. Either way, that's the spot at which, once you go closer than that, you'd need the speed of light to escape. So it's one way after that.
Right.
You're heading in. And then what happens once it reaches a singularity? Now, here's the problem. If you just use general relativity, it'll tell you that that bit of matter and everything else is just going to get smaller and denser until it occupies, ready for this?
Right.
Zero volume and infinite density. But now, this is what the rest of us would say. What does zero volume mean? How can anything take up no space? Is that just an idea, or is it possible in the real physical universe? We don't think it's possible.
It has to be an idea.
And exactly. And what does infinite density mean? That also is just a mathematical thing. It's not a real thing. So if those things aren't real, then something must prevent those conditions, and some have speculated perhaps one of the four forces of nature, the strong force in particular, steps in ways we don't yet understand to stop the further collapse of the singularity. And so it stops at a finite size, just as the other super dense things, white dwarfs and neutron stars, stop at a particular point. Maybe black holes do too.
Very interesting. Back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Dennis in Albany is on. Dennis.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm a recent amateur astronomer, and once I get my telescope out, of course, everyone wants to know, should they get a telescope, what kind? What I tell them, and I wanted to know, Bob, if you agree, is that I would start younger kids out with binoculars and, if possible, like a camera tripod or something. Get them used to seeing the sky. My experience has been that handing a set of binoculars and pointing them towards the Pleiades or something like that really gets oohs and ahs and gets them excited. I didn't know what you, is that a good idea? Should I be
continuing to do that? Oh, that's a great idea. I think you're totally right, and that's a great idea. A good pair of binoculars. These days, if they're rich, they can buy the new image stabilized type that keep the image from shaking in your hand. Or you just mentioned on a tripod, or even better yet, there are swing arm parallelogram shaped binocular holders, and then you don't have to clunk into the tripod. It holds it a distance away. And the most comfortable setup is you being on one of those zero gravity porch chairs with those swing arm binoculars, so the tripod isn't even near you. And now you can look at the heavens and look at things like you mentioned, the Pleiades. That's maybe the finest binocular sight in all the heavens. And yes, you're right. But it depends on finance. If someone's really rich, then get both. But if you're just starting out, and let's say you only want to spend $100 or $200, a few hundred dollars, don't get a cheap telescope. Get the binoculars first. Totally agree with you.
Well, that's a good call. Dennis, thank you very much. 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's see here. Oh, Michael. Michael in Albany, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. So the Trump administration has talked about bringing Americans back to the moon by, I think it was 2024. And I'm just curious what the scientific community, thinks about this. I think a manned moon mission would be neat, but just wondering if there's a lot to gain from a scientific perspective. Thanks.
It's a race again. Yeah. It's the Russians and the Chinese and
Well,
others.
It's the old thing. And if you talk to a number of astronomers, you'll get different opinions about that. And some will defer to the public and point out that after the first or second or third mission, people weren't even watching and paying attention to the further moon landing. So I think the public will largely see it as been there, done that. I think the public would be excited about Mars, but I'm not sure about a return to the moon. On the other hand, you ask what's there to learn. There's always new things to learn. But the question is, are the first things that we learned, for example, is the surface capable of holding up people or would it collapse? What's it made of? We now know what the lunar regolith is made of. It's all been analyzed. Those 832 pounds of lunar rocks have been, we know them thoroughly now. And there's some mysteries. For example, why is the oxygen on the moon the same isotopic ratio as the oxygen on Earth? The oxygen elsewhere isn't. Asteroids and other planets and meteors have completely alien oxygen compositions. Not the moon. The moon looks like it's made of Earth stuff. And yet our best theory of the moon shows that it was at least partially or mostly made from an object that hit us. So, yeah, there's still mysteries and there's still things to learn. And but they're increasingly subtle and geeky and scientific as you go down the line. Is it worth all the money? And
just said the magic word. Yeah. It's about money. I think there are minerals and things that I think that's what this race is about. I think the countries want to get a foothold and plant the flag because I think there are things to be mined. I truly believe that.
I disagree about the moon because its overall density is so low, and all the theories behind it show that its density being only about 3 grams per cubic centimeter, Earth is 5.5 grams per cubic centimeter, shows that there can't be heavy stuff there.
What about H3?
Helium,
yeah,
is different forms of helium. If we ever get into fusion, if fusion ever becomes a source of power for us, if we ever develop it and solve those problems, then the moon has some of that fuel. That could be valuable. But most of the moon is sand, and sand just is not, it's just not valuable.
Okay. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest, and now we go to Donald in Latham. Donald, you're on. Hello, Donald. How you doing?
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
More or less.
Yeah, I'm on a cell phone. Yes, I own a telescope. It's a Celeron 2080.
Yeah.
And when I look at something very bright, like the moon, it comes in crystal clear, but around the very edges is a little red hue. Now, someone that's into optics told me that that's called chronic abrasion.
Is there any fix for that? It's chromatic aberration.
Chromatic aberration.
Okay. Right, not chronic abrasion. I have chronic abrasion in the place where my elbows keep touching the table.
Thank you, Bob.
But this is chromatic aberration. Yes, your friend was right.
Okay, how do you fix it?
Well, it can't be because that's inherent to the telescope. Now, you have a Celestron, when you said 2080, do you know the diameter of, because all the models, I don't know all the models off the top of my head. This is Celestron makes all types. Is this a Schmidt-Cassegrain, sometimes called an SCT, or is it a Newtonian reflector, or is it a refractor? Do you know?
It has, what do they call it, I forget what they call it, a piece of glass that's in it. I wish I knew these things.
Okay, let me ask you this question. If you looked into the telescope on the wrong end, if you looked at the end that you don't look through, is that glass just a piece of glass, or does it have a second, it looks like a round, something that's blocking the very middle of it, a round circle? It has that? It has that obstruction.
And I had to culminate them when I got them because they were off. I got double everything, double images.
Yeah. Well, okay, here's the thing. Those type of telescopes don't usually have a severe chromatic aberration. So in your case, I suspect the problem might be in the eyepiece.
Oh.
So you might want to buy some high-quality eyepieces. They're not cheap. Like good companies such as Teleview that make high-quality eyepieces won't have that chromatic aberration.
These are binoculars, though.
Oh, binoculars.
Binoculars.
Oh, these are binoculars you're talking about? That model?
Yes.
The Celestron 2080 is a pair of binoculars?
Yes, they're really heavy and huge.
Cool.
Well, they're too bad, because that means that the chromatic aberration. And by the way, what you described is exactly where typically you'll see chromatic aberration. You see it on the interface between a bright and a dark surface. So the edge of the moon, where you see a bright surface against the black space behind it, that's where you're going to get the false color. Normally, it's actually purple or yellow. Red is a little less common, but it is chromatic aberration.
Okay.
And unfortunately, those eyepieces are built into binoculars, so there's not much you can do about it. What you could do is contact the company and say that you find it so bothersome, you'd like a different pair or you'd like a different model.
Now, those are probably not cheap. So maybe you call the company and say, hey, listen, we got the aberration.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
All right, over to Zach. Hello. Not our engineer. This is Zach and Troy. Hello, Zach and Troy.
Hi, how's it going?
Well, we're okay.
In a previous conversation with a caller who wanted to talk about electric universe theory, you mentioned something about, I believe, comets bringing most of the water to the Earth.
Yes, that's, of course, the classic and the standard explanation.
Right. I'm familiar with a bunch of articles online that are written up by PBS and Smithsonian talking about how there's three times the amount of water underneath the surface of the planet than above it. So for all the water in the oceans, there's at least three times the amount in rocks, some 400 kilometers down, I think.
Okay.
So it offers a geological explanation rather than an extraterrestrial one.
Okay.
I wonder if you had about that.
Anything to say about that, Bob?
No, that's not, again, that sounds like geology, which is outside my field.
You know what, Zach? I tell you what, the next time we do the science forum, we have a geologist there, Ed Stander, and he can probably answer that for you. But thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, but I will say that it's been a debated topic for many, many decades, how we got our water, because there is a lot of water. And, yeah, it would have to be a lot of comet impacts, and how else could we have gotten the water? Do understand, however, that water is the most common compound in the entire universe.
Right.
Since it's made of hydrogen, which is everywhere, and oxygen, which is the third most common element in the universe. So we see it everywhere. The rings of Saturn are chunks of water ice. The comet tails are water, mostly water. Many of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn now are revealed to be ice and water and have water pools under the ice. So it seems to be everywhere in the universe.
All right, let's go quickly to Matt in South Glens Falls. Hello, Matt.
Hi, guys. This is very interesting. I love it. My question is, my daughter and I have been looking through our telescope. I can't tell you what kind it is, but whenever there was a full moon, it looked like it was a reflection of something metallic that we were seeing, and we both saw it multiple times. It didn't look like a poof or, of any sort. It just looked like there was something metallic on the surface that was reflecting light. Is that possible?
So what you're saying is that a little tiny spot on the moon would suddenly glint or flash?
Correct.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. I find this fascinating. Again, neither I nor any of the many observers I know have seen this, but I'm very interested in getting reports. So yours is very interesting.
And modern astronomers, according to what we've been reading over the last week, have documented this for 50 years, although Bob and his buddies have not.
We haven't seen it, but I'll keep looking, and it's very interesting that you saw that. So it looks like you're on board with all the modern reports.
I want you to look into this, Bob.
I am.
All right, very quickly
Moon's
now.
Moon's coming back this week.
We only have 30 seconds. Eliza in Amherst, Mass. Is on. Eliza.
Hi. I have a quick question about black holes.
Okay.
They're always depicted flat. You know, they draw a picture of it looking like a record. And I'm wondering whether, in fact, mustn't they be spherical? And does that make a difference in the event horizon and how everything interacts?
Well, yes, they have to be spherical because the sphere has the smallest surface or area of any geometric shape. So it would pull itself into a sphere, yes. And as for black, it has to be black because it can't reflect light and it can't emit light. So you're left with black.
Bob, very quickly, I know there are a couple of open spots on the tour that you're going to Chile. How do people find out?
Special interest tours.
And what's the website?
And I think there's been a single cancellation of one couple. So you want to come to the eclipse next month, just four weeks away.
Specialinteresttours.com. Support comes from Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear, European styling on prescription and non-prescription sunglasses, eye exams by appointment, EYEDENTITY, eyewear, Albany.com. Colby Attorney Service, corporate formations, document retrieval services, court filings, and legal publishing for the legal and professional community since 1939, ColbyService.com. Quality Foreign Car Care, Boston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 30 years, QFCC.com. at Paul Smith's College, the College of the Adirondacks, or your campus is a 14,000-acre lakeside wilderness offering career-based education since 1946, paulsmiths.edu. Thanks again to Bob Berman. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Dina Salzman and Jackie Orchard for answering the calls. Zach Malloy was our engineer, for heaven's sake. Jim Lavoulis is our producer. Tomorrow on Food Friday, oh yeah, Polish food. The Polish Fest comes up. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Stand by for the Capital Connection.